Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance, go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
And good afternoon from Florida Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the August 28th, 2010 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, of all the shows we've done during the past year or so, this one, I assure you, will be our most solid. And that's because the vice president and general manager of the company that builds the space shuttle's solid rocket boosters will be on the show today. None other than Charlie Precourt, himself a four-time veteran of riding those big boosters into orbit aboard the space shuttle. Charlie will be joining us in a few moments to talk mostly about a big test of a solid rocket motor that's scheduled out in Utah this coming Tuesday. And he'll talk about some other issues as well related to the test and our use of solid propellant rockets in the United States. And throughout this next hour, you can join us in the conversation. If you have some questions or comments about anything having to do with the space program, you can join us as always by dialing 321-768-1240. AT&T wireless customers on the Space Coast can dial *1240 on their phones and make a free phone call here into the studio. Or you can send us some email to spacetalking@aol.com. We'll see that live here in the studio and get right to your email. Again, the address, spacetalking@aol.com. Well, before we do get to Charlie, I want to share some things about what's been going on in space this past week, and really more what's been going on with me at home in this past 7 days since last Saturday's show, when we had Robert Perlman on, a true brother among space cadets. We talked about space collectibles and astronaut autographs and topics of the like, and just triggered a wave of nostalgia in me that led me to hunt down some things online and some old space models and books and records and all of that kind of thing. But I was trolling around on YouTube looking at some space videos and came across something pretty incredible. You know, if you're a member of my generation, basically the very tail end of the baby boomers, and you were among those who watched the early days of our space program, Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, unfold on the black and white televisions, eventually the color televisions. Perhaps you stayed home from school like I did for every launch, stayed up for every moonwalk, made sure you never missed a splashdown. Well, then I encourage you to go to YouTube and search on this term, Zelko 321. It's Z as in zebra, E-L-L-C-O 321, Zelko 321. And I'll put a link up, a reminder on our Space Talk webpage about that. His collection of videos online is absolutely incredible. And if you, again, were among those to watch those early days, if you remember, of course, we all remember Walter Cronkite on CBS covering the space missions, almost as shuttle missions, the space missions of the early days. If you remember Frank McGee on NBC, Jules Bergman on ABC, if you want to relive what it was like nonstop in real time, everything except for the commercials, which I still wish I could have seen, but what it was like for them to cover a launch or a mission, you know, as it happened. This guy, Zelko 321, it's like he's got every video up there. They're not all there, but it's every mission is covered in some way. I have spent the past week downloading these videos and looking at them. They're in 10-minute parts, so you got to download quite a few files. And if you've got the right software, of course, you can stitch those together into one long file. But in any case, you know, watching Walter Cronkite cover the early Saturn Vs, the tones and everyone's voices for Apollo 8, the first manned mission to the moon, the first time that we were flying men on the Saturn V, and to hear them talk about that and what that was going to be like, it's, you know, long before Apollo 11, you know, obviously months before anyway. Incredible. Apollo 11 landing on the moon, of course, we've seen the famous shots shown over and over again of when they actually touched down on the moon, and Walter and Wally Schirra are there in the CBS studio, and Walter wipes a tear away from his eye and all that, and those are precious moments. Go to the point in Apollo 11, go to this video where Walter Cronkite covers the actual moonwalk, and Neil steps down on the moon, and he says, "That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind," and Walter's just overcome, and he tries to repeat the quote, and he doesn't remember it all. You know, at that exact moment, it was like he said, "That's one small step for man." What was the rest of the quote? What was the rest of it? Did he say? Can we get someone to tell us what that was? You know, of course, now it's part of history, but at the time, that moment recorded on video, those are just some of those priceless moments that are just fun to watch. My favorite in watching these videos this past week was all of the TV networks' coverage. There was a CBS video there, I think an ABC video, of the Gemini 6 launch abort. Now, I don't know if you remember exactly what happened then, but essentially you had Gemini 7 had been launched into orbit, and they were going to launch Gemini 6 toward the end of that two-week Gemini 7 mission to go rendezvous with the spacecraft. It would be the first time in history that two spacecraft had ever come together into orbit. They weren't going to dock, but they were going to rendezvous together. And Walter Schirra is the commander of Gemini 6, and the two of them are sitting in the capsule, and the engine fires, and then the engine shut down immediately, and there's this rocket fully pressurized, ready to fly. By all accounts, it had lifted off. The clock was started and all of that, and Wally Schirra just sat there. And what he was supposed to do was pull the ejection ring in the capsule and blow the two of them out of there. Gemini didn't have an escape tower. They had ejection seats. Very risky, very hazardous, and of course would have wrecked the mission totally. I mean, that's it. Your capsule's done. You know, you would not have had the. But he didn't feel the rocket lift off, so he never pulled the ejection handle, and in doing so, saved the mission. All that. Now, to watch the network guys cover this live, to see this rocket just do this thing, we knew all that later, but we don't know that then. We don't know what's going to happen, and to hear those guys talk about it and what they're watching for, and you know, these are critical moments. You know, Walter said something. These are very critical moments right now. Just the drama just was incredible, and just again, all those things that were inspirational to me anyway as a kid growing up in Minnesota, you know, and helped me lead my way down here to be a part of all this, was just absolutely incredible to watch. The voices, to hear the voices. Now, growing up in our family, because we were a Huntley-Brinkley family, and NBC was our news of choice and the Today Show and all that, I spent all my time watching Frank McGee on NBC. I never really watched Walter live. We always watched Frank McGee in our house. And one reason we did that is because NBC's coverage was sponsored by Gulf Oil, and which I thought was great because the Gulf Oil was like, you know, the Gulf of Mexico, and it just evoked Florida. And of course, we're stuck in the winters in Minnesota, and Florida's just this great place you want to come, and it was so distant and tropical and all that. And then, of course, when Disney World opened and the Car Care Center was sponsored by Gulf, it was yet another reason to go down there and be a part of all that, and it was just absolutely a great thing. So to watch Frank McGee covering all this with the Gulf Oil logo on his desk, what fun. So again, go to YouTube, Zelko321, search on it, have fun with those videos, download them, and just have a blast. And if you get the chance to send me an email to spacetalking@AOL.com, tell me about it, that'd be great. Well, look, we're going to take a quick break here, and when we return, we're going to have Charlie Precourt join us. He is from ATK, the makers of the Space Shuttle Solid Rocket Motors. They've got a big test coming up this week. He's a former NASA astronaut, and we're going to get to all of that with him just as we pause for this break. This is Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to WMMB.
This is Space Talk with Jim Behnke.
And welcome back to Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Again, our phone lines are open, 321-768-1240 for your questions and comments. Star 1240 for AT&T wireless customers. And once again, the email address from anywhere that you are, spacetalking@AOL.com. Again, you can hear this program streaming live on the internet right now at WMMBAM.com. And we encourage you online listeners to participate as well. Well, in just a couple of days, if all goes continue to go well, meanwhile, in Utah on Tuesday, to be precise, a solid rocket motor, very similar to a space shuttle solid motor, will be test fired on the ground. Only this motor will be made up of five segments, one more than the four that makes up a shuttle motor. There are other differences in the design as well that could prove useful in the future, especially as it relates to operating in colder weather. And here to tell us about that test and what it means and what engineers hope to learn from it, among other things, is the Vice President and General Manager of ATK Space Launch Systems, a man who has personal experience riding at least four pairs of solid rocket motors into space, none other than Charles Precourt. Charlie, who's talking to us from Ogden, Utah today. Welcome to Space Talk. Charlie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Jim. How are you doing?
Well, we're doing great. It's 83 now and humid here. I bet it's hot and not humid there.
That's about right. It's pleasant here today. A little cooler than it's been, actually. We had a front come through yesterday, so it's pleasant.
Are you going to do a cold weather test, and is it going to be cold enough to do your cold weather test, or is there a building surrounding the thing?
We have a building surrounding the thing, and as you say, and it's been conditioned over the last couple, 3 weeks now. We've been gradually reducing the temperature. We have a target of 40 degrees Fahrenheit for the what we call the bulk temperature of the propellant.
Yeah.
We're at 41 or so right now, so we're 40 plus or minus 3 is our target, and we're right in there right now, and we'll just hold that until Tuesday morning, and we'll roll the building back, and we'll be ready to go.
I could use my bulk core temperature to be dropped a few degrees right now.
Understand.
Especially as we get into football season, and the Vikings are playing tonight, by the way, so we're going to crank down the air conditioner and put on a sweater. So, Charlie, let's get into this, and let's talk about you and talk about your involvement in the program. I do want to spend just a moment or two on wearing the blue suit. You, four-time shuttle astronaut, and you've ridden these solid rocket boosters. Of course, we know that that's a pretty rough ride for the first 2 minutes, but give us a sense real quick of how you got into space business, what appeals to you about it, and maybe what your fondest memory is about being an astronaut.
Well, sure. You know, I grew up in the 60s and graduated from high school in the early 70s, right around the Apollo time frame, of course. Like a lot of folks of our generation, we were all inspired by that. And I was fortunate enough that my dad was involved in general aviation, light aircraft, and exposed me to flying at a very young age. I had an uncle who had been in the Air Force, and between those two influences, wound up at the Air Force Academy and pursued a career in flying jet fighters for the Air Force. And of course, a lot of the astronauts from the beginning have come from the military, in particular those who had been involved in flight test, which is an engineering discipline and an experience that is very much needed in development of spacecraft as well. And so it was always, for me, just an intriguing thing to be involved in. Got lucky in the 1990 time frame, was selected for the astronaut program.
And from there, you flew four times. And what's the big memory? What do you miss about being in space?
Well, you know, there's each phase of flight has its own joys and inspiring moments to it. For me, I flew four missions in a time frame when we were opening up our relationship with the Russians. And I flew F-15s in Germany in the Cold War and before the wall came down. And on the east side of the German border, the Russians were flying their MiG aircraft. And as luck would have it, my counterpart when I was the chief astronaut, the chief of the Cosmonaut Corps, Vasily Tsibliev, had been flying MiG-23s in East Germany. And who would have believed that the two of us would be flying together in space in the 90s. I was the pilot for the first docking of Atlantis with the Mir in 1995, essentially 20 years down the road from Apollo Soyuz, and then was fortunate enough to command two final missions after that back to the Mir. Just a very, very exciting time frame, and opening up that relationship with the Russians has just been a thrilling, very rewarding experience that has carried us forward into the space station that we have today. You know, and the flying experiences, the glorious view of our planet from Earth, from space of Earth, is something you never forget. Re-entry coming across from the northwest, we had a special re-entry on my third flight that was on what we call the descending node of the orbit.
Mm-hmm.
Normally we come in from the southwest to the northeast into Florida over the Yucatan Peninsula and Cuba. On this particular flight, though, we came in from over Washington State down across the Rockies, and it was a morning landing at Kennedy, and it was sunrise over the west coast, and we got to see the entire United States streak by in about 12 minutes. That's very, very impressive, of course.
Can't even imagine what that was like. You know, you talk about the Russians, and of course, Charlie, my favorite memory of you was in 1995. We were both in Moscow for Norm Thagard's flight, and we were on the balcony in Russian Mission Control, and you guys were standing there watching and monitoring, and I came in as a reporter to cover it, and the look on your face when you saw me was like, what the heck are you doing here?
Very true. Very true.
That was great.
You know, I remember being in Germany as a fighter pilot before the wall came down when Berlin was run by a quadripartite organization that involved the UK, France, Russia, and the United States, and I met my first Russian when I visited there, and it was almost mysterious to think that there was this society on the other side of the wall that we knew so little about, and here we are in Russia in that day and age, as you said, just very, very unique time in our history.
That's right, and strangely enough, their sky is blue and the moon looks the same. So, well, in any case, well, so you had the four experiences, and then you left the astronaut office, and you wound up at ATK, and tell us real quick here, we just got a couple minutes before our break, why solid rocket motors? Why ATK? And was there anything particular that appealed to you about it?
Well, you know, I was the chief astronaut after my four flights, and then I went on to a stint managing a space station program. And through that time frame, I selected the Columbia crew and was involved in a lot of the discovery of what went wrong during that, and the things that we should take away from that, and what we can do better. And as at the very beginning, as the Ares and Orion system started to develop for a brief period, I was also the program manager for the Crew Exploration Vehicle. Through a lot of, as for all, a lot of us, as your personal situations change, I just looked for an opportunity with our kids having all gone off to college. To try something different, and the opportunity to join ATK came along, and being a part of the development of the vehicle that could bring huge improvements in crew safety and reliability was a very exciting and appealing thing for me. So that was really the bottom line for me, was to take all that we'd learned and turn it into something great for the next generation.
That's interesting. Now, again, we've got about a minute and a half here, Charlie. Let's get into this test here on Tuesday. Give us just the very quick high-level overview of what you're going to do and why you're going to do it, and then maybe we can get into more details after the break.
Yeah, so as you, I think, mentioned in the beginning, we've added an extra segment for the sizing of the booster. And what that does is it takes the performance from about 3 million pounds of thrust up to 3.5 million pounds of thrust, which was determined to be needed for exploration. And so what we're doing here is we evolve the motor, and all of the design elements of any spacecraft, or shuttle included, they evolve over time, as you know, and we improve them. And what we've done with the transition from shuttle to Ares was to make some extensive improvements as we transition to the five segment. And one of the things that we want to do here is to prove in this second test, the capability of the motor to operate at the lower temperature range that we might expect in operations. We have chilled the motor down, and we're going to measure about 764 channels worth of data to take and make sure that the pressures in the chamber, as the gases exit the nozzle and the temperatures in and around the nozzle performance, all those things are exactly as we predict, because only through validation by test of our analytical predictions can we be sure that we've built what we wanted to build. And so we'll be operating this at 40 degrees, and we've vastly improved, for example, the joints between the segments, to the point we don't even need heaters in the joints anymore. We have actually better performance in the joints without the heaters, with the new materials that we have in there, than we did in the former joint with the heaters. So we're making great progress in the design overall.
That's great. Well, look, we're going to take a quick break. Charlie, please stand by. We're going to do our five-minute built-in hold. Get everyone caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports, and we'll be back with more with Charlie Precourt right after this break. This is Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to WMMB.
Be here for the heroes in orange jumpsuits.
Be here to feed your curiosity.
Be here for the goosebumps.
Major goosebumps.
Be here for the eye-opening.
Jaw-dropping.
Excitement.
Of exploring space.
Be here for a day of fun.
And a lifetime of inspiration.
Be here at Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. Now through September 6th, Florida residents receive a free child admission with each paid adult. Restrictions apply. Download your coupon at kennedyspacecenter.com/Florida.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Banky.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. 321-768-1240, still the number to call. Local AT&T wireless customers, you can dial *1240, or you can send us an email to spacetalking@aol.com. During the week, we invite you to stay in touch with Space Talk via Twitter. Our username is Space Talking, and of course you can visit the WMMB webpage to download a recording of today's show. Check out our Space Talk show page by entering in the keyword Space Talk. Learn what else is going on in Brevard County, and all doing all of that at WMMBAM.com. Today on the show, we're back with Vice President and General Manager of ATK's Space Launch Systems, four-time shuttle astronaut Charlie Precourt. And Charlie, before the break, we were talking about some of the things you're going to look at in this solid rocket motor test that you're going to conduct on Tuesday in Utah, where you are at right now. And one of the things you mentioned that was interesting to me was about the joint heaters and the basically the O-rings in the joints being of a new material. You know, there's a sensitivity around here, of course, because of Challenger. We're all, you know, still very sensitive to that topic and to the joints and all of that. And is this going to replace, would have solved that problem? Is this solved the problem forever? Is that how it works?
To the extent that technology has improved and allowed us with new materials, we found a joint O-ring material that is far superior in its resilience through a broader range of temperatures. And to the extent that it, over a lot of years of testing now, has shown that it's ready to go operationally. So that's one of the things we'll verify during this test, and it'll be a significant additional increase in the reliability. Of course, you recall that with the redesigned solid rocket motor after Challenger, we improved that joint tremendously, even with the older O-ring material. So now we've stepped that up even another notch. The beauty of the improvement over the years with the design is it's resulted in some reliability numbers that are hard to touch, frankly, and the shuttle program has borne that out with both analytical and operational use over the years, to where we've got an ever-improving design that has tremendous reliability.
Well, and you use that word, and of course, we don't know where all this is going when we talk about the future of our space program and what hardware is going to be used. Some interesting words from Congress this week about, you know, kind of almost dictating the use of a core external tank and solid rocket motors and all of that. So we know that's all up in the air, and none of our crystal balls know exactly what's going to happen with that. But in all of that, there is still some folks in the space community, and certainly a lot of folks outside the space community who aren't as fully briefed engineering-wise, that there's this perception, a lingering perception, that mixing humans and solids, at least in terms of solid rocket boosters, is still not a good thing. And yet, you know, from the way we're talking about putting on an escape tower and you know, maybe that was only the case for shuttle, and now moving forward with an escape tower with the reliability of these motors, that isn't such a problem anymore. Is that how you see it?
In some respects, I guess I understand what you're saying, and I think for some folks, maybe there is that lingering perception. The interesting thing is, though, that you know, if you think back about even Challenger, the booster had a leak, but the booster continued to fly extremely well. It was what we call collateral damage in the design, the way we had adjacent components that the leak in the O-ring actually caused the ultimate sufferer was the external tank and its propellant, right? So I think the thing to recognize is that the booster actually has higher reliability measures than the space shuttle main engines in the history of the shuttle from a statistical and an operational standpoint now with the redesign that has gone on. So what I have come to appreciate with the solid rocket motor is it has extreme reliability, and it also has very, very high operability. It, in the last 10 years has not, you know, knock on wood for all of these things, has not been a contributor to a launch delay due to any kind of a technical issue. And so what we've done with the lessons learned is we've taken this design and improved it to where the reliability has become really, really high. It really only contributes even on the big stack up of all the risks of flying shuttle. The top of that list is things like orbital debris and, mm-hmm. and the ascent debris from Columbia. And then, you know, the RSRM is way down the list. It only contributes to 5% of all of the risks out there. And that's due to the huge improvements. Now, the other thing that makes it very appropriate for us to put into future designs is its huge performance. It has a 3-to-1 thrust-to-weight ratio, so it does a tremendous job of lifting us vertically out of the atmosphere. And so what I really, really have come to appreciate with some of the designs that have evolved is a combination of the solid and the liquid engine systems. When we go to space, the trajectory to get there is almost two segments, if you will. It's a vertical segment and then a horizontal segment. Mm-hmm. And solids perform beautifully in that vertical segment where you need that high thrust to weight, and then the liquids kick in when you need to turn horizontal and finish the job of getting to space efficiently. So that combination has proven to be really, really effective from a performance standpoint.
Now, and in terms of the performance, and you added the fifth segment, and you talked about the increase in thrust, and you talk about the thrust to weight. I've always wondered, how big is too big? You know, how many of these segments could you stack on to each other? How big of a diameter could you go before either it weighs too much to get itself off the ground, or it's impractical to build? Or, I mean, what's the limitation? Is there one?
I think the limitation is more the size and design of the entire vehicle. It's interesting. You look back in the progression of designs. One of the follow-on concepts for Apollo, had it been continued, was to put solid rocket boosters on it to improve its performance. I think, really, Jim, the limitation is not how many more segments or how much bigger in diameter we would go. But what is the total payload that you want to lift? And so the fact that the solid rocket boosters perform at a 3-to-1 thrust-to-weight ratio means that you've got a lot of excess lift capacity there. So it comes down to how many boosters do you want to use, and in what kind of a total lift requirement do you have. So, you know, the Aries 5 concept was capable of 400,000 pounds to orbit payload, so that it's a tremendous amount of payload right there. Well, with the 2.5 segment boosters.
Well, as you get into this discussion of what we need in the future, you know, this is something I've been kicking around, and I'm only know enough to be dangerous, obviously, in terms of engineering and rocket science and all that. But, you know, so often we talk about what we're going to build and what's next and how many solids, how many liquids, whatever. The first question is, well, what do we need it for? What's our destination? What's the goal? And I kind of wonder whether or not it shouldn't be the other way around. Shouldn't we just build a rocket that we can afford, and however big it is how big it is, and we design the payload to the rocket, not the rocket to the payload? Is that just completely skewed or what?
No, I don't think you're completely skewed. I think, again, I describe getting to space as a two-segment kind of thing, a vertical and then a horizontal, and that's just to get to low Earth orbit. And regardless of the destination beyond low Earth orbit, as you remember, even in Apollo, we went into an Earth orbit and then did a transfer to a lunar transfer orbit kind of trajectory. So it's almost worth thinking about it as a staging orbit when you get into Earth orbit, from which you would accelerate on different vectors to any number of destinations, whether they be asteroids, the moon, Mars. And so fundamentally, if you build enough capability that gets you to low Earth orbit, the payload you carry is what would leave Earth orbit and go to these other destinations. And so, as I mentioned, a 400,000-pound payload certainly enables a number of destinations. And so I tend to agree that we ought to build the most capability for the funds available, and do so in a manner that thinks about multiple possible mission destinations.
Yeah, and I think going back to Apollo, I think sometimes we might have learned a wrong lesson in, and this may go over a lot of people's heads, but the whole lunar orbit rendezvous versus Earth orbit rendezvous versus direct ascent. You know, lunar orbit rendezvous got us to the moon in the goal, in the deadline, with the budget. But Von Braun and the gang had always wanted to do Earth orbit rendezvous, which means that if you needed a bigger spacecraft to go wherever, then you just launch two rockets, join them together in orbit, and go from there.
That's right.
And I think we so tend to want to go just to what we need for the one rocket. And I think we need a bigger capability, a bigger infrastructure for the space program that allows us to do whatever we want to do and go wherever we want to go. So
yes, and I think NASA has converged with the heavy lift studies on some pretty reasonable options in terms of capability. If you're too small, then you have far too many launches to assemble your capability in orbit. And you know, frankly, the space station's a pretty good example of that. We spent years building it. Granted, it's a much larger structure than you might want to envision.
Charlie, stand by for that. We're gonna need to do one more two-minute break. We're going to come back with some final words with Charlie Precourt. So stand by for that. This is Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Behnke. You're back on WMMB in just a moment.
Now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance. My guest again for these just remaining moments is a former astronaut, now an ATK senior manager, Charlie Precourt. And Charlie, just we've got the big test for your solid rocket motor on Tuesday, the five-segment version. Go back to some basics on this test, because I'm always fascinated by this. You've got this big giant thing laying on its side. How do you keep it from just blasting off into the Ogden sky?
That's a great question. So it's on a test fixture, and it has a large thrust block, we call it, on the front end that the motor pushes into, and it's actually an instrumented thrust block that will take and measure the torques and the forces that the motor is producing, and so that's actually a thrust block that is very, very massive in size and goes very far down into the earth, embedded into tons of concrete. There are some retainers along the length of the motor as well, but for the most part, it is not going anywhere. And we have it vectored such that the thrust plume steers up into the mountainside, and mm-hmm. we'll be able to do a full high-rate slew of the nozzle and vector the thrust as we would during normal flight, and we'll exercise it through an exact profile that you would see it fly during mission.
Do you put sensors or any kind of anything into the plume itself at any distances?
You know, we have in the past, and it just depends on the different requirements. What we're going to be measuring is the exhaust gas temperature, that the exhaust gas is reached in the vicinity of 5,600 degrees. We're mostly interested in things like the performance of the nozzle. One of the more interesting pieces of data collection is we have a large mirror that sits down range from the nozzle, and it reflects an image that you can see all the way down into the core of the motor.
Mm-hmm.
And a camera will be focused on that mirror such that at ignition you can see the entire ignition train occur.
Oh, really?
So that's pretty interesting.
Will there be good video of that available?
I would imagine there would be at some point here.
The whole ignition process is so amazing about this thing. We got to fire a motor in a motor, and you've got the, I assume you still got the star-shaped propellant inside, and it burns to a perfect circle at just the right moment. And
that's right.
You know, and all of that.
And a lot of people may have the mistaken impression that it burns from the top down or from the bottom up. But actually, these propellants are designed with a core down the middle that's just a hollow cylinder, if you will. And the propellants are adhered to the sidewalls all the way along the length. And so when it's ignited, a long igniter flame goes down the entire bore and ignites all the propellant along the length simultaneously. And so it burns from the center of the core outward toward the skin of the case. And as you said, there are fins cut out in some of that propellant core such that more surface area is exposed, which accelerates the burning. And it's that burning through those fins that actually allows us to tailor the thrust levels.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people say a booster like this isn't throttleable. We actually program a throttling of the thrust into the way we shape the propellant grain.
It's just amazing. Now, how close can you be? I know that you do a big VIP event out there. I was lucky enough to go out to Stennis for a shuttle engine test last summer, my first time ever. I don't imagine you can get that close to a solid.
No, we have folks, the VIP viewing area is just about a mile away, I think, something of that nature.
Is that more of a debris thing or a sound thing?
It's a safety and debris. You know, it's just the right, as we look at all of the safety aspects, we have a routine that we go through that we keep the test area clear for safety, and that's the way we've been doing it for years. So much like when you go down to watch a shuttle launch, I think most of the viewing area is about 3 miles away.
Yeah, interesting. Well, Charlie, we just got about a minute with you before I have to sign you off. Talk about the future of ATK. I know you've got a lot of folks working around the country for you, and you've got the plans to do different things. We know a lot of things are in doubt, but as you face the next the closure of the shuttle program and moving on beyond that, what's the mood and what are you looking at doing?
Well, you know, we have a long history with propulsion, and so we're pretty excited about a lot of different opportunities. Emphasis lately, as you pointed out, on heavy lift, and with the extreme thrust and high thrust to weight levels that we produce, we think the five-segment motor and derivatives thereof will be highly sought choices for designs like that. We, as you pointed out, we're working with a lot of different people. We have the United Space Alliance folks there in Florida that work very closely with us on the booster processing. They're a subcontractor to us for the Ares derivatives and going forward, as well as this test motor. They do a lot of the work with the hydraulic power units and the thrust vector controls and the aft skirt. We call it the structure down at the bottom,
mm-hmm.
working into the nozzle. The L3 avionics folks up in Ohio that work for us on avionics, which is the electronic brains that actually steer the nozzle and manage the motor. So we work with them. We have a number of other vendors and suppliers all around the country that that we work with in producing the rocket motor. So we're very excited, leaning forward towards getting started on heavy lift. We think that's a great initiative that the agency is looking at real hard right now. So.
Yeah, I'm excited about the future, too. I think despite all the hand-wringing, I think we've got a bright opportunities ahead of us. And I know this test will help give us some numbers to lead the way. And so with that, Charlie, we'll say thanks for being on the show. Good luck with the test, and I'm sure we'll talk to you very again soon.
Thank you so much, Jim. It's good talking to you again.
Good to talk to you, sir. We'll talk again. Okay, well, in our final moments here, as we say goodbye to Charlie Precourt, let's remind you a little bit about what's ahead in space coming up in addition to the test on Tuesday. You might be interested to know that the next Progress supply launch to the International Space Station, set to fly from Kazakhstan on September 8th. And then out in California, our friends at United Launch Alliance, many of them neighbors here, will be off in California, sending an Atlas V rocket into orbit carrying a secret payload on September 20th. Here at home at the Cape, we're keeping our fingers crossed that SpaceX will be able to launch their second Falcon 9 from the Cape by the end of September. And we've still got the Delta IV Heavy on October 19th. Shuttle Discovery on its last flight, targeted still for November 1st. Of course, remember, all launch dates are subject to change without notice. Please do not make any travel plans ever based solely on a launch date, or you will be disappointed. Next week is Labor Day, and we'll be taking we'll be heading home, actually, to attend the Minnesota State Fair. And there we will eat way too many mini donuts, cheese curds, and any number of foods served on a stick. Looking forward to it. So as a result, we will be broadcasting a Best of Space Talk show for you to enjoy next Saturday. And also don't want you to forget to participate in the Jerry Lewis Labor Day Telethon. Kurt Channel's involved in that. We encourage you to make a donation. We'll be back on September 11th with guest Bill Larson, a former space journalist. We've got a lot of neat things to tell you about there. That's it for today. Thanks again for listening. Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance, a production of Mila Solutions. Aaron Michaels is my personal chief engineer. The next show is Home Mortgage Law Show here on WMMB. I'm Jim Bankey, and we'll talk to you again real soon.